Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette, dated Wednesday, October 29th, 2025. Today on the front page of the News Gazette is a very large photograph with the title Family Tradition, Let the Fun Begin. And this is a picture of some very lively young women and their coaches with the heading Family and Friends Join Members the All-Area Girls Golf Team during a photo shoot outside the News Gazette in Champaign. Resuming a tradition interrupted by the pandemic, the News Gazette is gathering its all-star teams in dozens of high school sports for group photos to commemorate the occasion. At the top of the front page is an article with a picture of Julie Odom. And the heading is True Success Blossoms Through the Relationships We Build. Among the 31 local leaders who fielded questions from editor Jeff D'Alessio as part of the Women's Small Business Special section inside today's News Gazette, Julie Odom, owner and operator of Muhammad's Flora Design Studio, describing here the most impactful lesson she's learned in her journey. The most important business lesson I've learned as a florist is the value of trust and community. When I first opened the shop, I believed success meant carrying an overly heavy load, ensuring every arrangement and customer interaction reflected my personal touch. However, life has a way of resetting your values and reminding you what's really important. In 2023, my daughter Lily was diagnosed with breast cancer at just 20 years old. I had to temporarily step away from my responsibilities as a shop owner and as the senior florist for the University of Illinois, placing my faith in our teams at both locations and within our local community. That experience forced me to let go of control and trust others with the work I loved so deeply. I discovered how incredibly blessed I am to have two incredible teams that rose to the occasion with creativity, care, and commitment, and a community that surrounded us with love and support during our darkest days. I've learned that our business is about so much more than flowers. It's about people. It's about resilience, compassion, and the beauty that comes from working together. This journey has shown me that true success blossoms the relationships that we build along the way. Continuing on the front page with an article from Agriculture by Rob Lacates. Area corn, soybean harvest wrapping up. Farmers await news from the trade talks with China. Champaign County farmers are basically done with harvest now, a premier cooperative lead grain merchandiser said on Tuesday. At the end of the incredibly dry, drought-filled harvest, farmers now look toward the selling season. The grain company projected Tuesday that all 14 local elevators have nearly completed both corn and soybean harvest. Premier's Doug Kropp predicts the coverage area will finish within the next week. Grain elevators filled up as acres of crops flattened, and this season's one significant rain delay 2 weekends ago kept farmers in the field and workers like Kropp busy. We probably started working a week to 10 days earlier than usual, and we never really let up, Kropp said. We kept going, and it was fast, and it was dry. Champaign and surrounding counties experienced considerable rainfall shortages this year, with most areas well below the 12-month average. Soybean yields didn't leave fields without drought-sculpted battle scars. The ideal range for bean moisture levels ranges between 12% and 13%, but some farmers saw their crops in the 5% to 9% range compared to years prior. Beans in the single digits were drier and smaller, meaning a profit loss for farmers. Despite the season's dry conditions, the products turned out surprisingly well. The yields, while lower than last year and lower than we would like, were still really good, Kropp said. They ended up being a little better than what we had anticipated prior to the harvest, and overall we have to be fairly pleased with the yields given the weather that we had this year. Grain elevators typically derive some profit from crop dying, but with the parched conditions, crop drying, this was a down year for the company. since farmers required little, if any, drying fees. With nearly all soybeans collected, farmers now eagerly await a trade deal between the United States and its top overseas buyer, with no results yet. China purchased nearly 985 million bushels in 2024, which accounted for slightly more than half of the total U.S. soybean exports, according to FarmDoc. This year, the U.S. sold 218 million bushels between January and August. Between June and August, shipments to China were unnoticeable. On the bright side, crop heard positive rumblings about a trade agreement that boosted prices. This may be the good omen farmers have hoped for after seeing producer costs rise gradually in recent years. Crop said input costs like seed, fertilizer, and labor continue to grow as outputs remain in the lower end. Recently, we saw a bigger increase in the soybean price with anticipation of maybe getting a trade deal done in China, he said. So, prices have moved up, yet they're still below where we ideally need them for the farm to gain profitability. But they have moved higher throughout the harvest, which has been a positive. And there's a photo at the bottom of the front page, and it is of Starbucks workers. And they are the United members rallying Tuesday outside the coffee's chain location on South Neal in Champaign as part of a nationwide effort to pressure their employer to return to the bargaining table. The union has begun voting to authorize the strike, and it's a long line of protesters carrying signs here in the picture. And the last article on the front page is from the Urbana Police Department, with the heading, Cervantes promoted to deputy chief in a 4-2 vote, appointment set to expire after 6 months, by Jana Wersima. A longtime member of the Urbana Police Department was appointed interim deputy chief this week over the protests of some members of the public who opposed the promotion based on a controversial arrest the officer was involved in 5 years ago. The city council approved Mayor Deshaun Williams' appointment of Michael Cervantes in a 4-2 vote. Chris Evans and Grace Wilkin were the two no votes, while Mary Alice Wu, Cherise Hersey, Jaya Colasetti, and James Quisenberry voted in favor. Chandra Bishop was absent. Prior to the vote, about half a dozen people spoke against the appointment during the time for public comment. I would feel comfortable with Michael Cervantes as my new deputy police chief because of his conduct. I would not feel comfortable because of his conduct during the April 10, 2020 arrest of Alaya Lewis, said Lila Leopold of Urbana. At the time, Urbana police officers were called to the 1100 block of East Colorado Avenue for a report of shots fired. A gun was found on Lewis's companion, who was arrested. During the encounter, the 21-year-old Lewis yelled at the police and resisted when Cervantes grabbed her arm. This led to a chaotic physical altercation between Lewis and multiple police officers, which was caught on video by a bystander and sparked accusations of excessive force and racial bias. An outside review of the incident found that after Cervantes attempted to put Lewis's arm behind her back to be handcuffed, she hit him in the face with her left hand and swung at his head with her right hand. He then brought her to the ground, and other officers joined in working to arrest her amid a struggle, including Eric Ruff, who hit her in the head and kneed her in the ribs. Cervantes, a sergeant at the time, came out of the incident with a broken thumb. "We are called to do a job, and we have to do that job with the information that we have at the time to the best of our abilities, while keeping in mind that the public safety aspect is one of the most important things. So keeping the community safe, keeping the officers safe," he told the News Gazette in an interview on Tuesday. In the instance of Lewis's arrest, Cervantes and the other officers were responding to a shots fired call and didn't know who had the weapon, he said. "I feel that given the totality of the circumstances, I did what I thought was best in that moment," he said, "and I am comfortable with the decisions that I made in that moment." The matter was reviewed by the Urbana Police Department, the state's attorney's office, and Chicago law firm Hillard Heinz, All three reviews found that no laws were broken during the incident and officers acted within department policy. However, Hillard Heinz also made several recommendations to the city, including incorporating de-escalation more explicitly into the department's use of force policy. Lewis, who admitted to having consumed an edible Xanax prior to the incident, ultimately pleaded guilty to resisting arrest and was sentenced to 18 months of probation. As part of her plea agreement, three counts of aggravated battery to a police officer for punching, kicking, and spitting were dismissed. "I want to acknowledge the pain that this is bringing up," Colasetti said. "I think that it's very clear that this community has never had a chance to heal from that incident." Colasetti said that when Cervantes' appointment was first proposed, she told the mayor and police chief Larry D. Boone that the council needed answers about what occurred and that they were given significant time to review video footage of the incident and understand the context of what was happening in that moment. She added that she had focused on objectively reviewing the individual actions of Cervantes, not anyone else involved. "The decision that I will be making tonight would be different if we were talking about a different individual," she said. Hersey recalled that during the period of public outcry surrounding Lewis's arrest, one of her fellow aldermen had wondered why more of the black community didn't come out and say something about what had happened to this young lady. "And my question was basically the same," Hersey said. "And part of that, when I talked to the people in my constituency, was that it was a situation that didn't have to happen on either side." She also believes that Cervantes has grown as a person, and his promotion to lieutenant since shows that he's also grown as a police officer. "Cervantes has been appointed for a term that will end in 6 months. We can see in 6 months where his leadership takes us," Hersey said. "And if we don't like that leadership, it can easily be taken away. We don't have to vote him in again. We don't have to appoint him again. But I do think that everyone deserves another chance." Wilkin, however, said she has concerns with Cervantes' behavior and also noted that she was not in favor of adding a second deputy police chief to begin with when the change occurred a couple of years ago. "We have a very tight budget," she said. "We have other projects we're working on, like the alternative response and enhanced training." According to city officials, Cervantes has over 22 years of experience in law enforcement and has been with Urbana in a number of roles since 2006. He most recently served as a patrol division lieutenant. "He's steady, he's humble, and he leads with his heart," Boone said. "And at the end of the day, most of us can do policing, the nuts and bolts, as I like to call it, of policing. But at the end of the day, you want a force that leads through the Constitution as well as their heart. And the majority of my officers do that every day." Cervantes said that he recognizes the community's frustrations and that there are still wounds that need to heal. However, he added that calling all officers a certain obscenity, as one speaker did, doesn't help bring us all together. "And that's what we need," he said. "We need the community, and the community needs us. We need to work together in order to find that common ground. And to me, that common ground should always be community safety, and that should be the thing that's paramount." He also feels that the police department is taking a lot of right steps when it comes to collaborating with the community. "As far as anything that happens in the future with alternative response, of course we're going to have community buy-in in any of that. But when those things happen, it's going to be much more efficient for all of us to work together," Cervantes added. During the time for council input, Williams said that he believes in protecting both the safety and dignity of folks. "Like everyone here, especially as a minority, I'm tired of corrupt policing and systemic harm, especially when I'm, again, outside of my suit and tie," he said. "Under my leadership, I think that I have shown, over the past 6 months especially, accountability is non-negotiable. It's non-negotiable under my leadership. But at the same time, so is the possibility of growth, especially if it's real and measurable. I don't expect everybody to agree, and frankly, I don't want everybody to agree with me. But that's the way in which I lead. Second chances, they're not blank checks." According to city officials, Cervantes is the department's first Hispanic deputy chief. Continuing now to Section A8 with some more local news from the Champaign County State's Attorney, financial exploitation charges against Urbana Man dismissed. Reeds believes case should be handled as a civil matter. By Luke Taylor from Urbana. The case against an Urbana man accused of financially exploiting a disabled person has been dismissed after further investigation. Shannon Cowper, 62, was charged in 2022 with stealing over $13,500 from a disabled person that he lived with. However, Champaign County State's Attorney Julia Reed said that it has been determined the case would likely be better handled as a civil suit. Further investigation led to the conclusion that we would be unable to meet our burden of proof with regard to criminal intent, Reed said. According to a Champaign police report regarding the case, before it was dismissed, Cowper and his wife moved in with 59-year-old man in August of 2016 to care for him because he has intellectual and developmental disabilities and his mother had died. Cowper's wife was related to the 59-year-old, the named victim in the case. In July of 2019, the victim's sister was alerted by his employer that Cowper came to the victim's workplace to take him to the bank. The sister asked Cowper about it, and he said he was moving money around in bank accounts so that the victim would not be denied Social Security benefits. The sister also learned around that time that the house the victim, Cowper, and his wife were living in was also being foreclosed on. According to the report, the sister then moved her brother in with her and hired an attorney to look into his finances. The lawyer found patterns of bank withdrawals that were uncharacteristic of the brother. Those had not happened before Cowper moved in with him. Cowper was charged with a single count of financial exploitation of a disabled person, a Class 2 felony. He was not detained awaiting the resolution of this case. Let's jump over now to the opinion section with J. Mark Powell and his Holy Cow History, with a large picture, a vintage black and white picture of Bess Houdini seated at the last seance, and Edward Saint Wright with a beard and other unidentified men standing around her as they hold her hand around a big table. The article has the heading, Hollywood Calls the Hereafter. The spookiest time of year is upon us once more as our attention turns to jack-o'-lanterns, black cats, and things that go bump in the night. It was also this time when the widow of one of the most famous entertainers of the 20th century tried to communicate with the departed. Here's how it happened. Wilhelmina Beatrice Rahner, called Bess by her friends, was in a song and dance act on New York's Coney Island in the 1890s. She started dating a fellow performer, a young magician. She quickly fell in love with his big brother, Harry Weiss. He took notice of her, too. Like his kid brother, Harry was also a magician and an escape artist. He felt Weiss lacked panache, so he changed his last name to Houdini, a tribute to the earlier pioneering French magician Jean-Eugène Robert Houdini. At first, Bess joined him as a magician's assistant. His feats improved, and audiences grew bigger, and by the early 1900s, he had developed the stage illusion that put him on the map, escaping from a locked box. Known for his ability to wiggle out of handcuffs, he added feats of daring, such as escaping from them while hanging upside down, sometimes even suspended from skyscrapers. He had perfected his act just in time for the roaring 20s, when gimmicks were all the rage. Silliness was in style. There was flagpole sitters, goldfish swallowers, dance marathon contests, and more. And Harry Houdini was one of the biggest stars of the era, until fate had a trick of its own for him. During a break between shows in Montreal, a college student visiting Houdini's dressing room asked if it was true that the magician could withstand any punch in the gut. Houdini said it was. Without warning, the young man repeatedly delivered powerful blows to the star's abdomen. Houdini's appendix was seriously injured. True to the entertainer's maxim that the show must go on, he kept performing until he eventually collapsed. He was rushed to the hospital and died 1 week later on Halloween Day, 1926. Bess was devastated. Theirs was a genuine love story, but she held out hope of hearing from him in the hereafter. Years before, the couple had agreed that after one of them died, they would try to contact the other. They even established an elaborate ritual to confirm their identity, complete with secret code words known only to them, to guard against fraudsters. Harry was supposed to signal Rosabelle, a song Bess had sung in her early days on stage. Over the years, she attended multiple seances on Halloween night, trying to reach Harry. Nothing. In the early 1930s, she took up with Edward Saint, a former carnival showman who partnered with her, to keep Houdini's legacy alive. Although they lived together, she was careful not to remarry and thus lose her right to call herself Mrs. Harry Houdini. Finally, as Halloween 1936 approached, they decided to not only end the annual ritual, but to go out with a bang. It was the 10th anniversary of Harry's passing, and they turned it into a media spectacle. They billed it as the final Houdini seance and staged it on the rooftop of the Knickerbocker Hotel in, where else? Hollywood. The iconic Hollywoodland hilltop sign appeared in the distance. The land wouldn't be dropped until 1949. Carried live on the radio, attendance was by invitation only, with the ceremony starting promptly at 8 p.m. Bess sat in a giant throne-like chair in front of a table that held Harry's photo and a candle that she claimed had been burning since his 1926 passing. A pair of locked handcuffs, his trademark, rested on the silk pillow. The zero hour of the 10th anniversary of our departed friend is fast nearing the end, Saint intoned melodramatically. He then launched into a 10-minute, appropriately eloquent diatribe that ended with his flourish. We have waited, Houdini, oh so long. Now is the night of nights. Speak, Harry. At that point, a recording of Pomp and Circumstance, the same tune Houdini had used for his stage entrance, was played. The audience waited. And waited, and waited. Finally, Bess announced, my last hope is gone. I do not believe Houdini can come back to me. I do not believe that ghosts or spirits exist. The Houdini shrine has burned for 10 years. I now reverently put it out. She blew out the candle flame and concluded with a simple, it is finished. Good night, Harry. And that was that. Asked before her own death in 1943 why she had stopped holding the seances, her answer was straight to the point. 10 years is a long enough to wait for any man. And that's perfect for our Halloween, which will happen Friday. And we have time for a different opinion piece by Jim Dye today with the heading, Top DC Dem Faced a Tough Gerrymander Cell in Illinois. How does a skilled legislative map drawer gerrymander a state congressional map that's already been gerrymandered? For starters, it ain't easy. Second, it's even more difficult if the beneficiaries of the current map want to maintain their current advantage. That's the problem U.S. Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, the Democratic minority leader, confronted this week when he scheduled a Monday meeting in Chicago with members of the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus. He was hoping to persuade caucus members to back his plan to redraw the boundary lines of the state's 17 congressional districts in the hope of knocking off one of the state's three Republicans, U.S. Representatives Mary Miller of Oakland, Darren LaHood of Peoria, and Mike Bost of Murfreesboro. Miller and LaHood are said to be the main Democratic targets, according to the news accounts. But redrawing a GOP district where he could create problems for a Democratic district there, theoretically jeopardizing a seat held by one of the 14 Democrats in Illinois' U.S. House delegation. That's why the remap idea has been dismissed by many. Still, it's not dead yet, kept alive in part by Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker. Pritzker has expressed outrage that Texas Republicans redrew their state congressional district boundary lines to pick up seats now held by Democrats. He initially threatened to do the same here and then was persuaded to drop the idea, but he's dropped hints that he's back on board. I don't know what the right answer is, but I can tell you that I'm not going to sit back and let it happen, he said recently. If something is to happen, it could be this week in Springfield, where legislators are meeting for a brief legislative session. But time is growing short because candidate filing season began on Monday. At the same time, Republicans in states like Missouri and Indiana are pursuing redraws, while Democrats in California and Virginia are doing the same. But it's more complicated here, because, as noted by Springfield political analyst Rich Miller, possible redistricting is about both D's and R's and black and white. He writes many black caucus members oppose Jeffries' plan because they believe a map redraw could lead to the state's black voters losing black representation in D.C. because the new districts would be significantly more white. That possibility is an anathema to black caucus members still angry over a GOP state house win over a black Democrat in 2022 race. In an East St. Louis district, Miller said caucus members believe racial dilutions had gone too far. Illinois' current congressional map is a mishmash of bizarrely drawn districts, none more so than that of the 13th District Democratic U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski. It resembles a snake running from Champaign County to the Missouri border, splitting another district. Locking overwhelming numbers of Republicans in three districts allowed Democratic map drawers to spread Democrats around liberally in the remaining 14 districts. But if they decide to move Democratic voters in and GOP voters out of those three districts, it could tip the scales in a Democratic district, particularly one with a black incumbent. That raises a question state and federal Democratic politicians must answer. Do they love themselves more than they hate President Donald Trump? So far, their personal political interests are trumping efforts by Jeffries to round up enough House seats to guarantee Democrats win back a House majority in the 2026 election. But for how long? In today's paper, there's a whole section that is devoted to celebrating National Women's Small Business Month for this month of October. And there are many short biographies of very successful ladies in our communities and surrounding community, and I can read some of them. I'll sprinkle some in here before we go, and then I'll come back to that in our second half. On the front page of this is called Win the Morning, Win the Day. Before turning the page on National Women's Small Business Month, editor Jeff D'Alessio convened a panel of 31 local leaders to talk lessons learned, mental health management, and celebrating wins, and more. And the first woman we have to celebrate here is Jane Reefsteck, principal at Champaign's Reefsteck Wakefield Fanning & Company. Honestly, I have a standing therapy session every 2 weeks. You don't always need solutions, just someone who listens and acknowledges the challenges one faces as a business owner, mother, and woman. I also try my hardest not to bring my work home. My job demands my attention, but my family does too. And setting those boundaries eliminates one more thing to juggle while I'm taking kids to activities, making dinner, or relaxing at home. Sometimes it's a nap on the couch, singing in the car with a fun drink, staying up late to read, or watching a little mindless TV. For me, anything that lifts my spirits and brings joy counts as self-care. The key is to fit it in wherever and whenever you can, without guilt. I start each day with coffee, meditation, prayer, and devotion. That quiet time helps me set boundaries and stay focused on the vision I have for my life and business. It has made me a calmer person in many ways. I'm not perfect, none of us are, but this routine has shown me that consistent growth looks like I finish my morning with a 45-minute walk, breakfast, more coffee, and then I'm ready for a business call. This is Diane Clifton, a designated managing broker and owner of Champaign's Live Real Estate Group. I try to nurture my mental health by creating as much balance in my life as possible. I prioritize my spiritual and physical health and find joy and see the beauty of life in simple things. Another woman to celebrate is Shayla Matuka, partner at Savoy's Matuka Elhiti Emkes, LLC. I prioritize giving back to the community, spending quality time with family and friends through activities like walking, yoga, and pickleball, and traveling. A particularly memorable travel experience was celebrating my 50th birthday with a trip each month for a total of 50 days that year. And we're going to take a break here. We'll return with some more of these successful ladies and the rest of the News Gazette as I come back with the second half.